Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron, www.thematthewaronshow.com, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter. You can follow us on Facebook through the Matthew Aaron Show. You type it into the search bar and you click like, and then you will get all our updates on Facebook. On Stitcher, you can follow us there. On iTunes, you can subscribe and leave some comments. So we're all over the place. The best place to listen to the show is obviously thematthewaronshow.com. That is the best place. And you could find me, I'm sure, on Facebook and Twitter and send me your emails as I get hate mail every day. Nothing new there. Mark Pellegrino is joining us today. Great actor. Along with Peabody Award winning great actor Nick Searcy. So, we got the elite coming on the show today. I'm joined at this moment by Michael Turzo, and Lee Capreas is outside waiting for the rest of our company. Mikey, how are you?
How are we doing, guys?
Guys, I'm the only one here. How are we doing, guy? Guys, good.
Yeah, pal, how are we doing, pal?
I'm good. Yeah. Well, we got filming this weekend, and then I got to go to the gym tonight, and I got script coverage to do, and I got I'm busy, very busy, very stressed. This show is almost like a break from working, even though it's work. So,
you know what? When I used to work two jobs, sometimes my second job was a break from my first job. It was,
I was laughing. We were talking about Mikey on top of, because we're making an indie film, so there's only, we have a crew of like a cast of like close to 50, but we have a crew of like 10. So you have to divvy out extra jobs to people that are willing to give you some extra time. And we asked Mikey to fill in his AD because mostly on an independent film, an AD job's basically like your number one security guard. Plus, you know, it's taking care of everything on set too, props, all that kind of shit. And Mikey goes, "All right, so what do you guys need from me this weekend?" And I'm like, "What the fuck are you talking about? What do I need from you this weekend? It's an AD job. I thought Anthony told you. It's literally like five things. It's the shortest email ever. It's bullet points going boop, 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 boop. Like the text I sent you that said boop, 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 boop. That's about it. And then talk to Wimp, whatever he needs. My DP. Anthony sends Mikey this email that was so vague and general that I have no idea. I have no idea what he was talking about. Mikey, explain to our audience that he described as the assistant director job.
Well, if I was describing it to children, I would say color your book blue and red, or sometimes red and blue. And then when you go up the stairs, make sure you go down and try to do your laundry, whether it's clean or dirty, and make sure to pick up your room and then throw the clothes and, you know, toys back
now,
on the floor.
Now, Mikey sends me a text giving me shit today going, "Maddie, you ever going to tell me what the fuck you need from me?"
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, "Anthony sent you an email." Now, I didn't read this email at this point. I've been really busy today. So I read it, and I go, "All right, I'm about to lay into Mikey because I know this is going to be the most well-drawn-out, bullet-point-laden email ever because we sat at dinner last night talking about all five things I need from Mikey. Literally, I had to go to a dinner with Anthony last night and spend a half an hour talking about what I need from Mikey." Okay? So now I feel like I've wasted a half an hour of my life, at least. And I read this email, and I'm like, okay, that's the most vague, general email ever. It might as well just said, "Show up."
Yeah, right. I mean, it was like, it's like when you ask your girlfriend where they want to go for dinner, and they go, "I don't care, just as long as there's food."
Yeah, right, okay. So I then had to apologize to Mikey and then write him a 10-page long text saying, "This is what I need from you." I thought this was handled. So these are some of the independent film things you're going to run across when you're making a film is, even though I have five producers, is it? Anthony does a lot of the work. I'd say Anthony does the work of three of them, and I do the work of two when I should really be doing the work of a director. So that's always fun. That's good times noodle salad. I got to go to meetings every night with Anthony and listen to him yap about insurance and permits like I give a fuck for like an hour. When he talks to me about permits, I just say, "Do you got the permit?" He's like, "Yeah." "Okay, great. The permit, do you want to know where and
no.
how?" And
no.
Nope. Don't care. Look at it like this. I'm Jimmy Caan in The Godfather, okay? I'm Sonny Corleone, right? I don't give a shit how it got done. I don't want to know how it got done. I told you to get it done. And that's all that matters. And as long as you got it done, I don't really care how it happened. I don't want to know. So did it get done? Yes. Insurance, did it get done? Yeah, here's what happened. No, I'm good. Because you, and we all know Anthony. As in Mikey's famous terms, Anthony likes to build a clock instead of telling you the time. So instead of Anthony just telling me straight up, "Yeah, it got done. Everything's candy. Don't worry about it." He's like, "Well, here's what happened." So I call the insurance people, and he'll give you like a transcript of the phone call that lasted 25 minutes. And you're like, "I don't care what the broad ate for lunch that you talked to at the insurance company. I don't care. I just care that it got done." So I'm eating last night with Anthony. It was just like the most annoying sit-down ever. I'm like,
Things don't turn out good for Jimmy Caan in that movie.
No, they don't. But my point was, up until that point, he doesn't care, doesn't want to know, and neither do I. I don't want to know what happens. Don't want to. Don't care. Did it get done? Great. Wonderful. It's on you. That's your job. It's your job. So that's been fun. What else do we have? Oh, I got rehearsals tomorrow.
Hey.
Because we have a new actor taking over as the lead. And it is and it isn't his, like, first gig. I mean, he's done stuff, like, for fun. But I don't think he's ever done anything like this. So I thought it would behoove us And especially have Melissa Dupre there tomorrow as well, because Melissa is a very accomplished actress. Listen, as a director, I have to say to myself, okay, you got this kid, and it's his first movie ever. And we're not sure how good he's going to be or how not good he's going to be. So I want to make sure the first scene he shot this weekend was with someone acclaimed like Melissa Dupre, great theater actress and comedian from Chicago. Okay.
Yeah, she is good.
4-star review for her last play, Luna Gale, in the Tribune. She's raved about. Critics love her. She's great. And she's a really good actress. So I want to make sure Maddie's first scene he shot was with a pro. Because it may take a few more takes. It may go a little longer. But I think he's going to learn a lot from Melissa. So we're going to have rehearsal tomorrow. And I think Melissa's going to kind of snap him into shape. And I told Maddie ahead of time, I'm like, you know, if Melissa kind of snaps on you a little bit or wants you like a little more on your game, she's just looking out for you. Don't get scared. Don't get your confidence wavered. It should actually build your game. Because, I mean, that's the kind of movie we're doing. I took the advice of David Gordon Green. And I casted interesting people instead of professional actors. And this is the con compared to the pros. This is the con of that where...
The Jimmy con.
Yeah, right. Speaking of cons, yeah, all show all the time. The thing is, it's kind of like a Cracker Jack box. Or it's like the mystery-flavored pops... what is it?
The one you used to go to the Greek restaurant?
Yeah, right. You don't know which. Yeah.
And it has the question marks on it. And you're like, ooh, I wonder what it is. Yeah. And then sometimes you taste it, it's delicious, and then sometimes it's
always
not.
Pineapple.
It is always pineapple at the Greek joints. What was the Airhead? They finally figured out what the Airhead mystery flavor was.
The white one?
Yeah, the white one.
Yeah, what was it? Pina colada?
I don't remember, but it was like something very similar to that.
You know what you get?
My argument was because they sell Airheads to kids. They made a pina colada flavor and couldn't call it pina colada, so they called it mystery.
Mystery.
That's honestly my theory.
Well, no, where else you saw the question was on a thing of dum-dums. Remember those
dum-dums
things?
Dum-dums, that's what it is. Dum-dums, that's the one at the Greek restaurant.
But those suckers, the dum-dum one was just grape. Like, it was always just grape. Like,
no, I mean, I
think it was pineapple.
The ones at Omega were always pineapple.
They were always pineapple.
I'm like, this one tastes just like the last one. And I remember I grabbed, like, 3 mystery ones to be like, oh, they're all going to be different. Mystery flavors,
isn't it
right?
Amazing that that's the birthplace of drama, that country.
The Greek restaurants, I believe Mark Pellegrino's calling in. Are we ready to talk to Mark? Maybe the most evil man in acting history. Mark, is this Mark?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, what was it? You got to laugh like Lucifer, too, right off the bat? What's going on, brother?
I do.
How you doing?
Hanging. I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Let me tell you something right off the bat, and I got to tell you. So I look at you as an actor, and I mean, I grew up when your career started taking off with like Lethal Weapon 3 and all that. And I look at you as an actor, and I'm like, all right, this guy has like the looks of a leading man, but there's something sinister about his face. Is that fair?
He has the looks of a leading man, but there's something sinister about his face. It must be fair because I think a lot of other people agree with you.
Yeah. You get like a lot of bad guy roles. I'm like, I'm going to make my next movie and I'm going to make Mark Pellegrino a good guy because what the hell? He's always a bad guy.
Oh, I'm always a good guy in my own mind.
There you go. That's right. That's how you have to do it.
That's right.
I remember I talked to David Morse once about this, and David Morse never considered when he was playing a bad guy. He couldn't look at it as he was a bad guy because he had to come up with the reasoning and the motives for why he was that guy. So in his mind, he was never a bad guy. Is that kind of how it is for you as an actor?
Yeah, that's the way you got to do it. You got to justify everything the character does, so you got to get on the character's side. So as far as you're concerned, you're the good guy, and everybody else is just getting in your way.
Yeah, I know. And then what happens? So here's what I've noticed with great character actors like yourself. You're either pegged as the bad guy, or the other role that you get offered a ton is like FBI agent. Is that right?
I've had a few of those in my day, yeah.
He has great answers. There have been a few FBI.
But I, I think I only have a few of those because I'm not very good at delivering that kind of CSI type dialogue where you just ramble on a bunch of techno speak. That's not really my vibe.
Yeah, I can kind of tell. I can see where that's the case there. And for a guy who's done as many movies as you've done, as much TV as you've done, let's just get right to it with the simpleton question that all the TV reporters ask. What do you like better, TV or film?
Uh-huh.
You know, I think it depends. You know, they both have their good points and their bad points. You know, TV is getting so good now. You know, I think a lot of feature actors and a lot of feature directors and writers are going to TV. So there's almost no difference.
Yeah.
I mean, the only difference is the speed. I mean, in most TV, you're shooting so fast. You know, 6-7 pages a day sometimes, and it's pretty crazy. And you have a lot more time in a feature film. But you know, I mean, people have TVs in the room the size of movie theater. So. They're becoming indistinguishable now, don't you think?
Yeah, no, and I was talking with David Krumholtz yesterday about this, because you did an episode of Numbers as well, right, Mark?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, we were talking about Numbers, and he was talking about how basically there was no time to screw up on that show with all the technical mumbo-jumbo, because basically you're filming 44 minutes of a TV show in 7 days.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Yeah, I mean, that's serious. That's, I mean, with Tomorrow People, right? Which, and by the way, I can't believe, there's part of me that can't believe this show got dropped. I understand, I think they maybe thought like there was a glass ceiling for the ratings and then probably the cost of the show didn't justify it or whatever. But it's a good show, but with something like the Tomorrow People, I can't imagine that being shot in 7 days. Was that the schedule?
Yeah, pretty much. It was an 8-day schedule.
Okay.
So it was fast as hell. Yeah.
That is really fast.
Yeah, that's crazy for me, especially a show like that. Or like Revolution. What was the schedule like on Revolution? Because that is a big budget show. You would figure they give you a little more time to work everything out and make sure it's good.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was basically the same schedule for Revolution, but it felt a hell of a lot longer.
Yeah.
I mean, the first day I was there, I think it was 100 degrees out and 95% humidity.
Oh.
It was wool uniforms. It was madness. And you know, the first season was pretty confused, as many first seasons can be. So there was a lot of delays and long days with nothing seemingly happening. So it felt a lot longer than the eight days that it's supposed to be.
Can I ask you, so because Tomorrow People, this was a very recent cancellation, and pilot season's already begun, even though there isn't much of a pilot season anymore. I'm sure there's lots of things you can go out for, but do you miss out on opportunities because you're waiting to see if your show's getting renewed?
Yeah, you can, or you know, you have to inform anybody who wants to test you for another show that they have to test you in second position. So
right.
Not a lot of shows want to be second fiddle. So you end up missing out. But I was kind of fortunate this year. So I was able to audition for a couple of shows even with second position. And it looks like I may be doing one, you know, starting next month. So
oh, that'd be great.
That's good.
For our listeners, explain for our listeners what exactly is a second position. That sounds like a ballet stance.
It feels like a ballet stance. No, it's just that a show basically gets in line behind the primary show that you're in, and they have to. They're basically controlled by whatever the primary show does. So they have to set their schedule according to the first show, and they only get you when the first show can release you.
I see.
That's
pretty crass. I mean, it's pretty crass.
Yeah,
yeah. That's what happens. It's tough because then, like the show that has you in second position, they're like, well, you know, what the fuck are we gonna do? You know, we gotta find someone else.
Right.
They're always gonna be looking for somebody else.
Right.
Yep. So that's hard. So you can't talk about the show that it looks like you're gonna be doing. Is it network? Is it cable?
It's cable, but I don't know that I can talk about it because nothing's been signed yet. I've just been informed that, you know, they're in negotiations right now. So
No, that's smart. We've had a history of guests coming on the show who reveal things before it gets signed, and then they call me up and they're like, "I'm gonna get fired, bro."
And
we gotta change.
And
it.
Their studios hate us.
Yeah, that's never happened before.
I mean, no.
Let's just say you can marvel at this, how this happens.
Yeah, it does rhyme with Schmarvel. They don't like me too much, no.
Yeah.
So talk to me about what it's like to be like you and Nick Searcy, who's our next guest on the show today, and Nick's a dear friend of mine. And you guys are like really the working man's actor. You guys are character actors who get tons of roles all the time. Even when you get regular leads on a show, you're doing guest spots on other shows. What is it like to always be hustling and always be on the move as an actor like that? Is it exciting? Is it kind of a hassle sometimes because you're juggling so many things at one time? How does that work?
I mean, I would say yes to all that. I mean, it's exciting, and it's nice for people like me who have a touch of ADD to change atmospheres as often as possible and keep things stimulating. But, you know, it's scary too, man, because you go on these shows that have been going for a couple, 3, 4 years, sometimes 5, like in the case of Lost, and everybody knows everybody. They're comfortable with each other. You know, they've got a rhythm, and here you come, the stranger, the new kid on the block, and it's like you get nervous every time you go on and until you start to find your rhythm within that new place. So it's a whole bag of tricks, man. It's good and bad at the same time and fun and scary and all of that stuff.
When I think about you as an actor, the guy I could see you working out really well with, and I'm shocked it hasn't happened yet, is Kurt Suter. I could see you being a regular on a Kurt Suter show really fast. Do you like Kurt stuff? Do you watch Sons of Anarchy at all or The Shield?
I don't watch much TV.
Yeah.
But I know those shows are pretty damn fantastic and have a huge following. I know people are addicted to Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah.
And I seem to recall, I read scripts and then promptly forget them if I don't need them anymore. And I go on auditions and promptly forget them if I don't get them because, you know, I think you have to do that to survive.
Right.
But I think I recall going up for Sons of Anarchy.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. I think I recall going up for the pilot. I don't remember what character, but I remember
vaguely. Could see maybe being in line with Kim Coates' character. I could see you and Kim Coates going to battle in a few audition rooms. I could see that. You guys have very similar styles. I think Kim Coates and you together, that's a tag team.
Wow.
Did you know?
Maybe that was it.
Do you know Kim Coates? He's great.
No, not personally.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah, good guy.
Guy and great actor. I think he's a great actor. Who are some of your favorite actors? Why'd you get into acting? Who inspired you and who continues to inspire you? I'm always interested who people's favorite guys growing up were. Like, I could maybe see you as a Paul Newman guy. No?
I love Paul. Oh, Paul Newman was great.
Yeah,
Paul Newman was great. You know, but I didn't want to be an actor at first. And even when I was an actor, I wasn't sure that I wanted to be an actor in the beginning. Yeah, I wanted to be a marine biologist and then got to college and found out that science didn't quite work for me. So I was going in the wrong direction.
At least you tried. Most kids nowadays don't even want to be marine biologists, okay? We were just having this conversation.
I want to be a reality TV star.
Yeah, reality TV is the number one gig now. So you wanted to be a marine biologist. What got you into the acting?
I dropped out of school. I did well. I did very well in college, but I dropped out after the first year and was just kind of wandering around and not really knowing what to do. And I saw some advertisement for some little modeling agency. It was kind of a modeling agency / school. And I went in there just thinking, well, maybe I could do something like this. And then they had a free commercial workshop. I took that, and the teacher there liked me and set me up with an agent. And so I started acting before I even knew I wanted to act and before I even knew how to act. And actually got my first job before I even knew how to act.
Man, some people got it for that. They got to hate you for that. You fell ass backwards in it.
Fell ass backwards in it. And then my agent at the time gave me a list of acting teachers to you know, to get some kind of craft going. And I picked the one that was closest to me and the cheapest, and it happened to be the best theater company, I think, probably in Southern California. And I started studying and took it very seriously, but never took movies very seriously or TV very seriously until recently, to be honest with you.
Wow.
Well, I'll tell you something. TV seems to be more akin to theater because it seems to be based more on the writers and the performers. So I can understand that sentiment. Movies seem to be more about the director, and I think the making of it is more akin to music.
Yeah, I'd agree with you totally. But you know who blew me away as an actor when I started to understand craft is Brando was like my first love. And then it's just, you know, all those great guys, De Niro and Pacino. Pacino in the 70s was untouchable, you know, and Duvall and all those guys, John Voight, were just amazing to me. But you know who kicks my ass now? He's a total movie star. He's been nominated, but I still think he's a totally underrated guy, is Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
Okay.
Leonardo DiCaprio blows my mind.
What did you like
him
in?
Every time I see him.
Oh, everything? You like him in everything, huh?
Yeah.
Well,
maybe that's lame, but I saw Wolf of Wall Street.
He gets the best projects.
Yeah, he's got – yeah, he's pretty lucky.
Yeah, he gets the best
projects,
for sure, yeah. Mikey,
he's
what was
good,
your
he's versatile.
You know, I was going to ask Mark, you know, I looking up your filmography, speaking of, you know, great movies and interesting projects, what was it like working on Mulholland Drive? Did anybody know what was going on in that movie?
That's a great question.
Well, you know, when it was first shot, it was shot as a TV pilot.
Right.
And believe it or not, it was a linear script. It was a girl who goes through amnesia and hooks up with this actress. And the girl and there's these hitmen chasing her, trying to kill her. She's got some weird connection to some mob, you know, family or something. And it was too expensive for the network to keep. It was something like, at the time, it was something like $7 million to shoot. So Lynch grabbed it and cut half of it and reshot it. Brought me back in to do, you know, a couple scenes in there. And I said, well, you know, that when we did the pilot, me and the makeup artist did, you know, I had a brown eye and a blue eye. He's like, that doesn't matter. Don't worry about it. I said, we also put like zits on my face and we did all this special makeup stuff, which, you know, if you look at it again, check it out. When I kill the guy, I've got a brown eye and a blue eye. And then when you see me talking to Naomi in the diner, I'm
right.
As normal a face as I can have is there. And he's like, don't worry about it. And it was weird. I went to the press screening of the movie and had no idea what I'd just seen.
Yeah, right. No, there's some great aspects of that movie. I've seen it probably four or five times. I discovered it, you know, about 2 years after it came out. And I just, like, you know, I'll, like, remember scenes about that movie. And at first I'm thinking of, like, four different movies. Then I realize, no, that was all the same movie. I just still don't know what.
That's great.
That's great. Yeah. No. That's how I felt watching Mulholland Drive. I go, this is great. What the fuck's going on?
I have an actor friend of mine who is totally obsessed with that movie to this day and is still weaving the plot and has tons of theories.
Well,
about
I gave up about 3 years ago. I finally.
So, Mark, who are some of your actor friends? Because I noticed a bunch of actors, like for instance, I know Nick Searcy and Stephen Root are good friends, and I always find that to be fascinating. Who are some of the guys you hang out with?
You know, Scotty Kahn is a friend of mine. I've known him since he was 15 years old.
The Kahns are a running theme on today's show.
Old Scotty.
Are they really?
Oh, we were talking about really? Jimmy. We were talking about Jimmy Kahn for about 20 minutes before you called in.
Wow.
That's funny. So, yeah, Scott's great. I love Scott. I love his theater work, too. He does great stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I did a couple of his plays at at Playhouse West, you know, when he did 9/11 and Minor Holidays. I was in both of those two plays. And then he did something at the Falcon Theater, but I didn't get a chance to see it. I was working. But, yeah, you like his theater. Yeah, he writes good, man. He's a good writer. Doesn't like to read, which is an interesting characteristic of a guy who's so good at writing.
Hmm.
You know, Jeff Goldblum and I work out sometimes. We not with weights or anything.
You guys I got to see Jeff Goldblum in the weight room.
Is he a cardio man, or does he stick more with the...
Whenever he does a play, he tends to bring it back to L.A. and just workshop it over and over again. So I whenever he did a thing with Kevin Spacey, he did Speed the Plow, and then he brought it back to L.A., and he and I worked on it with a group of people from our theater company because he thought he was going to do a little world tour with Spacey. And then when he did Seminar, when he replaced Alan Rickman, he brought that back to L.A., and we rehearsed that so he could – he worked on it at the Amundsen.
That's great. I love when actors say worked out. Like, I'm ready to go to the gym. Mark's talking about rehearsing.
Yeah, rehearsing.
That's like industry lingo. Industry lingo.
I'm too old to work out with weights, man.
Really? Come on. You're not old at all.
Compared to Jeff Goldblum?
I'm not compared to him. He's really old, but I'm beat up, man. I went to the gym for the first time in a month today.
Really?
Yeah.
I would pay good money to see Goldblum in the weight room.
Oh, yeah.
Not on cardio. I don't care about that. In the weight room, I'd pay good money.
If you put him and like Woody Allen in the same weight room. you could just turn the lights off and they'd still be talking.
What
weights would be lifted.
What are these? Do we lift these or do we have them?
Should we lift these up? What should we do? What do you think?
They're sitting there on their necks. Don't want to disturb anything.
Well, those guys are lucky. They have like the best metabolism ever. They don't have to go to the gym.
Yeah,
I hate people like.
Jeff is very health conscious, and you know, back in the late 90s, he had a gym in his house that he used to work at 6 days a week, man.
Wow. All right.
So he was a fanatic about it.
I'm going to have to ask him about that. I need to know.
I got to say.
Look at him in Independence Day.
He was in great shape in Independence Day. I'll give him that. He was in good shape. Yeah. That's true.
I apologize for the bulk of this interview now being about Goldblum.
No, because now I'm planning out a new podcast in my head where I talk to Jeff just about working out. That's it. I'm not going to bring up any movies, nothing. Just...
Oh, yeah, by the way, you were in that diner search, but tell me more about the treadmill.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Mark, you got to work out Speed the Plow, which is a mammoth play for those listening.
That
Chicago
is like
guys.
Exercise.
That's got to...
mammoth.
Listen, that had to be fun, though. I mean, doing Speed the Plow with Goldblum, even just sitting around bullshitting with it, that's got to be a good time.
It was fun. Yeah, I had a great time with that.
He's a good
omen for me because he likes to rehearse every day, and just as I start to rehearse with him, I always get work somewhere else. So it's like working with him means I'm going to get a job somewhere else.
That's great. I love that you're a guy, though, that really didn't have any interest in acting, wanted to be a marine biologist, but all of a sudden you spend time doing theater work. I mean, most guys that do, like, end up acting even though they wanted to be something else, dropped out of school, whatever. You hear that story here and there, but none of them end up going to do theater. They're, like, happy doing movies, and they're like, I got the luckiest job ever. I don't have to do any real work because movie acting isn't that hard.
Right.
You actually are like, all right, I'm into this now. Let's do some theater.
Well, you actually do work, which is rehearsing, which is
right.
like something that's, like, I guess, kind of old-fashioned.
Well, I mean, Mark doesn't have to go workshop a play that he's not even going to be in with Jeff Goldblum. I mean, he just goes and does it. That's cool.
Well, you know, I feel like the American actor has no continuity. So you have to kind of make that happen for yourself. And I remember before Rod Steiger died, he kind of became my mentor after this little short that we did.
Man.
And he used to say, you know, that he, you know, you should get on stage twice a week at least. And so I, that was my Rod Steiger.
It wasn't a bad Steiger. It wasn't bad.
Steiger, apparently still did short films before his passing.
That's why I'm loving this story.
I love
right
that.
Well,
yeah.
That's what we did. That's what we did a short film together that Jeff directed. For Chanticleer, and he played my dad in it.
Jeff played
and
your
that's
dad?
How I became... No, Rod Steiger.
Oh, Rod. I hope it was Rod, yeah.
Jeff directed it.
Wow.
And it was a pretty interesting little short called Little Surprises.
I try to get up
on stage at least twice a week if I can.
That's great, man. I just love how your passion – see, but this is a great story for me because your passion for your profession kind of developed after your 30s, which is great for me because that's like
– gives us hope.
No, but also look, you could fuck up in your 20s and be fine. You don't have to discover what you're going to do with your life when you're 18.
Yeah.
He wanted to be a marine biologist, falls into acting, and now he loves it. He started loving it after he fell into it. That's great.
Yeah, I loved the craft. I loved the craft after watching, you know, these kids in the theater company and how they worked. But, you know, the movies and the TV and all that stuff, none of that really had an effect on me until my wife came into the picture, believe it or not. She introduced me to foreign film and to cinema and, in a way that I wasn't. Wasn't really used to. I never took it very seriously, and now I do. I see how important it is, and what a place it has in culture, and it's important. And I like being a part of it now, as opposed to just kind of going along for the ride.
Yeah, so much to the detriment of a lot of badly under-researched marine life.
Right.
Indeed.
What else did I wanted to talk about? I wanted to talk about, we talked about Tomorrow People a little. We talked about your upcoming slate that the show that I think Mark would be great on, I don't know why I was thinking this today a lot, was I'd love to see Mark on Ray Donovan.
Yeah.
That would be great.
That'd be
good.
That's
the show I want to see him on. Yeah. He'd fit in like a glove over there. Oh, that's what I was going to ask about Mammoth, because you did Spartan as well. How was it to work with Mammoth
for
you?
Great. I was kind of terrified because, you know, I thought he would be a stickler for the words and would want, you know, every I dotted and T crossed. He turned out to be real loose with it. And he was the only director that I've ever worked with, and I've worked with some really good guys. He was the only director that gave me an action. Didn't give a result, didn't say you should do the feel this or be more angry or upset, you know, the typical kind of result-oriented direction. He came up to me and he said, you know, these guys are always looking for an escape. Try to escape. And so during that little section of the movie that I was in where I'm, you know, trying to kiss Val Kilmer's ass and get him to, you know, untie us and let us go, that's all I did was try to get out of there, try to look for a way out. And I thought that was a really great piece of direction. And he doesn't like technique or anything like that.
He doesn't want people to capital A act. He wants you to sort of be natural and just be yourself if this was happening to you. And I guess when you understand that, I guess it's very easy to work with him.
And I also worked on The Unit, too, which is his thing.
Yep, that was his as well, yeah. And how was that on The Unit? Was he as involved on The Unit as he is with his films?
No, he wasn't directing the episodes that I did, a couple episodes of that. You know, and he's the executive producer, so, you know, he had a staff of writers that would write, and then he would come in and, you know, rewrite it, basically. So you'd see the draft that they wrote, and then you'd see his corrections, and that was pretty much the extent of his involvement. I never saw him on the set there.
That's cool. I just know he wrote that impassioned note of his when they were canceling the show or whatever to his writers about the crap that they were writing. He was upset about it.
Yeah.
You can find that on the internet somewhere, I'm sure. It was it was classic Mammoth from the stories you hear. But we met Mammoth, and like it was the same thing where you're kind of like intimidated by him as soon as you see him. And then he was like a really chill dude.
He's a great guy.
And he's a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
That's right.
That's pretty cool.
He's obsessed with martial arts.
Yeah, that's why he did that movie Red Belt.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's obsessed
with it. I haven't seen
it. It's good.
It's actually really good.
Yeah.
It's shockingly good.
It's about one man's dogged refusal to corrupt his principles in an amoral world.
Yeah.
Did you write the back jacket of that? That's fantastic.
Hey, you know, you worked with a bunch of directors, though, that have a reputation for being a little testosterone-filled and a little crazy. A guest from our show and someone I love a lot, Billy Friedkin. You did Hunted with him, The Hunted.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Love The Hunted.
All right, now that you made that noise, I need to know what that noise was about.
The Billy Friedkin noise.
Yeah, that's the Billy noise.
Well, first of all, right before I did The Hunted, I was doing this little TV show called The Beast, which went for about like 8 episodes and then disappeared off the radar. But Frank Langella was the lead of this weird little show, and I kind of bonded with him, partly because like my character really had father issues, and so we kind of just unconsciously bonded with each other. But I told him that I was going to be working with Billy after this TV show, and he looked at me and he went, I said, "What does that mean?" He's like, certifiable. Certifiable. Fantastic. So then I worked on it, and the first day I had like a 2-page techno-speak monologue from hell, which I just don't do that stuff very well, which is why I get hired once for FBI agents, and then they see that it just doesn't pan out because I can't deliver all that techno speak. And every single time I would get about halfway through, which meant one page of solid dialogue, and then I'd just kind of go up. Every time around the same time, I'd go up on the lines. And, I'd go up once, and he'd go, "Cut! All right, you okay, Mo? Is everything okay? You got this?" I'm like, "Yeah, Billy, I know it. I got it. I don't know why I'm going up." He's like, "All right, let's try it again." I go back. I go up in the same place. "Cut! You know, Mo, you better sit the fuck down there and learn your goddamn line." I'm like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa."
That's Billy
being
nice.
No.
By the way, Mark's
impression's
pretty good.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good Billy impression.
Yeah.
That's everybody's Mo. There's another actor on the show who has an even better story about Billy coming down to him and giving him inspiration for a scene where he gets killed by Benicio, I think, where he comes traipsing. I guess he wasn't showing enough fear, and so Billy came traipsing down. He's like, "Look, this guy's got a really big cock, and he's coming after you to fuck you in the ass." I don't know if I can say that, but...
Oh, man.
Anyway, he was... All I told Billy was like, "Look, just put a 1,000-foot mag on there. Let me just keep doing it until I get it right." And he let me do it, and we got through it okay. And then he walked up to me after we got done shooting, and there were these pictures lining the walls of this office. And he goes, "Hey, Mo, come here." I go over to him, and he goes, "You see that picture right there?" I look. It's, a woman smiling, like a picture of an FBI agent. I said, "Yeah." He goes, "I fucked her." I said thank you for that, and he's like, "Yeah, okay."
It sounds like between Billy Friedkin and Gene Hackman, we got two new friends, man.
Yeah, right. I just love how Billy's doing a movie that his wife is the head of the studio on, and he's telling everyone how he's fucking people in his office. That's lovely.
Yeah.
Good job, Bill. Yeah. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Good old Sherry Lansing. Yeah. Whatever happened to Sherry Lansing?
She's still around.
She's kicking.
She runs like Stand Up for Cancer or something. I don't know how she puts up with Billy. It's none of my business, but
probably because it's easy compared to putting up with stand up comics.
Oh my God!
Billy's an interesting guy, and when I saw him in ADR, I thought for some reason he'd go ape shit on me because he was just so unpredictable. I walked into the ADR studio and he's like, "Hey, you're really good in this picture, Mo." Thanks.
Did you almost get into it with him, though, when he told you to sit down and learn your fucking lines?
Yeah, all I said to him was, that isn't going to help. Doing that doesn't do anything for me, so let's just... He has no editing device, man. I don't care who you are. I think he'd just get up in your... And he looks like a dentist or, a proctologist. He doesn't look like the type of guy that would, cut your balls off in public.
What happens is when you're completely tactless, that kind of comes off as being good business sense.
Oh, man.
Wow.
You know, and when he was on the show, and I love him, and I'll have him on again anytime because he can weave, he can tell a story, and you suspect a good portion of it may be bullshit, but you know what? It's a great story nonetheless.
Right.
Oh, he's smart as hell. You know, he's no shit smart, and he can tell a story. That's for sure.
Oh yeah.
But
oh, yeah.
He doesn't allow he doesn't allow cast chairs or anything on the set. I don't know if you know that.
Well, I'm okay with
that. Nobody sits down on the set.
I got ADD. I wouldn't be in my chair anyways. I don't think I could do that.
Well, you know what you're getting into after all this time.
Yeah, right.
You sign on to
right.
one of his
well,
pictures.
Frank Langella warned you, and that was all you
and
needed
Frank
to know.
Frank is as cranky as it gets.
Well, and Frank wrote that biography. Did you ever read Frank's new biography he wrote, Mark?
No.
Oh, my God. He talked shit about everybody.
About everybody. About Paul Newman, who got along with everyone.
Yeah, right. Frank was burying everybody.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's brutal.
How could you talk shit about Paul Newman? What did Paul Newman ever do wrong?
Now, listen. I know that you're, like, buddies with Frank, so I'm not gonna disparage him too much, but the guy talks shit about everyone who's dead. No one alive, though.
Look,
no one alive.
I'm not buddies with Frank. I actually.
Oh, okay.
When I was at the SAG Awards for Capote, I walked up to him hoping, hey, you know, I had such a great experience with him. He was such a mentor, and he was so kind and fatherly. I walked up to him like, hey, Frank, how you doing? He looked at me like I had leprosy, and I said, Mark, I worked with you on the Beast. He's like, oh yeah. It was like a shame. It was like something, a memory he would have rather pushed out of his head. And there I was, like a PTSD flashback.
That's okay. The only person he talks shit about that's alive in that book, I think, was Lauren Bacall, and that may only be because Frank thought she was dead.
Yeah.
I mean, I just watched The Big Sleep the other day. I don't know if you've ever seen this movie, The Big Sleep, Mark, with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. It's from 1946. I can't believe Lauren Bacall's still alive and looks great.
Looks good.
And looks great. Yeah. She's got to be like, what, 90?
Yeah.
Holy cow. And what a great movie, The Big Sleep.
The best,
is.
Yeah.
What a great movie.
Yeah, it's
great movie. And, you know, I met her. I met her in 98. I met her in Prague.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
How was she?
I was with Rod Steiger. This is kind of a weird experience. Steiger used to take me with him to these film festivals. And I'd be kind of his, you know, I'd be Max to his Norma Desmond, you know, and I'd be his assistant kind of, and he looked at me as his assistant, not as a fellow thespian, but his assistant. And I remember Lauren Bacall was there in the lobby of the Intercontinental Hotel, and Rod was there, and I sat down with and watched him play her like a goddamn piano. He was like he was playing hard to get. He's kind of beaten up on her a little bit, and she just kept coming for it. Like, I think I asked him later, Ron, you seemed a little bit rude to her. Yeah, she likes it. She likes it.
Oh, man, that's great.
Yeah, I'm glad you cherish those memories with Rod Steiger.
What a cool thing.
I got to tell you, it's the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
It's great that you recognize that, though, because some guys I know in the business are friends with all these legends, and, like, you wouldn't know it. They don't respect the fact that they are.
No, I loved the time with him, and I picked his brain, you know, about Brando and you know, how he got into acting.
Didn't you do an episode You did an episode of Criminal Minds, too, right, Mark?
Yes, yes.
Was that when Montaigne was there, or was that Mandy Patinkin?
Yes.
It was.
No, it was with Montaigne. Yeah,
yeah,
I love him,
he's the best.
I love Mandy Patinkin, too, man. That guy's a genius.
Yeah, I agree. Mandy's just a little... I think he gets bored of things easily is really what it is.
Yeah.
But Joe took over that show, and we used to do the podcast from Joe's restaurant in Burbank.
That's right.
And Joe's just the best guy. So I wanted to see if you remembered working with Joe, because he's great.
Oh, yeah. He's a great guy. Really, really nice. Really nice. A lot of my scenes weren't with him. It was like one of the climactic bust scenes had him in it. But, you know, we sat down and all kind of ate lunch together a couple days, and he's really a good guy.
All right. Now, I got to ask you this because I've asked everyone that's come on the show who's worked with this guy their story, because everyone says he's actually a great guy, and they don't know where the gossip comes from that he isn't. David Caruso, CSI Miami.
Oh.
Got to work with David. Was he fun?
Oh, my God. All right. Well, see, I have mixed feelings about David.
Yeah.
Because... Because he kind of was nice to me, but he was also like directing me. Now, I know that, you know, he's kind of the man on the show and everything, and in a way, it's kind of his prerogative. But I think it's really bad taste for one actor to direct another. I would never presume to do it. I remember when we were doing National Treasure, this one kid. He's a really good actor. But he was just enthusiastically telling Harvey Keitel, like, oh, maybe you should do it like this. And Harvey went, are you directing me?
Oh,
and
man.
The whole, we all kind of backed off, like, you know, somebody just set off a timer on a grenade and we had to get out of the general vicinity. But David kind of thinks it's his prerogative to direct other actors. And he would say things to me, you know, and so some of them were a little hokey, but, you know, I played along. I didn't want to lose a job and, you know, get in a fight with the guy.
Right. Yeah.
But he kept cutting down this one scene that he was in because he didn't have a lot of dialogue. So he kept cutting down the scene and whittling down the scene to almost nothing because he didn't want to sit there kind of with his, you know, with his putt in his hands, just looking at a scene, you know, without his verbal input. He's like, I don't know. I don't really know what to do. So let's just kind of cut the scene down. And the scene is, you know, he's interrogating me and he thinks I'm lying. So, you know, they turn the camera around on me and suddenly for the first, you know, he's, you know, when the camera's on him, he's posing, he's taking his glasses off, you know, he's doing all this stock stuff. when the camera turns around on me, he's looking at me like he's analyzing my open pores. I mean, he's looking at the blackheads on my face. He's seeing how my teeth grow. He's really looking at me. And they say, cut. And I went and I said to him, hey, Dave, that's what you should have been doing during your side.
Oh, man.
That's good. That's really good.
You're still talking about him nicer than Frank Langella would have.
Yeah, right. Frank's not a Caruso fan.
Yeah.
Well, Caruso's still alive.
Yeah,
so.
Right. No, who's the nicest person you work with? I imagine Kara Sedgwick's got to be like the coolest broad ever.
Yeah.
Was she the
Kara
best?
Kara Sedgwick is really cool. I loved working on that show.
I bet. She's
and so is fan. So is Mary. Mary was amazing. Mary and I bonded really, really
oh,
well.
Oh, yeah, Mary
for
McDonald's
some reason or another.
She's great.
She's great.
She's got her
great.
New show.
That
now.
Whole right. Yeah. That's right. All the same producers and stuff, and most of the same actors. It's that show is really like a family, man. I remember one day someone was doing my hair, and the next week she was directing the episode.
Wow, that's really
and
cool.
Done,
I've never heard of that in my life.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of it either, but that was the place where you could really grow and become what you wanted to become. James Duff is a really, really, really cool guy.
That's cool. That's cool. And Capote, you did Capote, of course, with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Bennett Miller. Bennett Miller is looking to probably go 3 for 3 here with this wrestling movie he's got coming out with Steve Carell and Channing Tatum and Mark Ruffalo. It looks great. What is it about Bennett that brings out great performances in actors?
You know, Bennett is he has amazing sense of the truth, and he's got a massive bullshit monitor, and he doesn't let anything escape him. The thing about Bennett that I really love Bennett. The thing about Bennett is. That was intriguing to me was he kind of had the opposite emotional reaction that you would think. Like when he thought something really sucked, he kind of smiled and nodded and laughed a little bit, and you thought, holy crap, he really likes what's going on here. But really, he thought it sucked. And when he thought it was great, he was very serious and thoughtful. And I love that about him. It's kind of savantish and cool. And he I think what also makes him really, really great and able to bring out performances is that he's sensitive to what the actors need. I mean, Capote was his first film, and he started out kind of directing and, you know, saying the typical things that a director says, like action, stuff like that. And within a week, you know, you just heard the cameraman say, set, and then you took your own cue and did your action from wherever you wanted to start, basically. So it's very liberating for the actor, because somebody saying action is a little disturbing and sometimes can take you out of it.
No, it's great. He's involving you in the creative process more than some directors do. What was your first brush with, like, a big A-list megastar? Was that, like, probably Mel Gibson with Lethal Weapon 3, or who else
yeah.
did you... Yeah, that was probably it. And what was your, like, what were you feeling at that time? Do you remember?
You know, I've never been really starstruck by anybody. There's very few people that would do that for me. It's a little surreal because, you know, you watch this person in the cinema, you know, and then suddenly you're there with them. But he was actually really, really cool to me. And
he's a nice guy. I like him. I like him. He's a nice guy.
He was a nice guy. He invited me to his trailer. He's like, hey, I'll make you a cappuccino. And we talked about Hamlet for an hour.
I believe it. I totally believe it. Totally. I know Mel a little bit, and he's always been a really good dude to me. Now, can I say what he's been to other people? No. But also none of my business. He's been good to me.
Right.
Just like he was good to you. So it's hard to say, like, well, I can't tell you, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, he's a good dude to me. So that's great. So you had a big first-time experience with Mel Gibson. Now you've pretty much worked with, like, everybody. Who's like, your favorite person?
Well, that was one of the most interesting directions, too, from Richard Donner.
Yeah?
We're sitting there. Richard Donner's in the camera truck right in front of us. You know, we're doing the fight scene in the armored car. And this is Richard Donner's direction. Get it up, 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 and action!
It's like a drum major.
I turned to Mel. I said, I guess we should get it up. Let's go.
I like Richard Donner, but that's fascinating. I mean, I'm directing my first film right now. We're doing this indie in Chicago. That's why we're here. And I can't imagine ever saying get it up for anything. And my film's about gay men. So I get it up. It makes sense with my film, and I still don't say it. I don't know. I don't know what Dick Donner was going for there. It seemed to work out okay.
Dickie Don?
Does it always kind of make you laugh when directors give you ridiculous direction, and then you have no idea what they're talking about? You nail the scene, and they're like, perfect.
Yeah, right.
Or that was great. Like, their direction helped you, and you're like, yeah, whatever, buddy.
Right.
Yeah, that's quite a phenomenon.
I love that. I love that about the whole process. But Mark, I mean, I've had a blast talking to you. I wish you had more to promote right now. You're kind of on a little break here right now, huh?
Well, you just did The Boys of Abu Ghraib.
What's that?
Don't we have a Boys of Abu Ghraib?
No, that's Sean Astin.
Really?
Are you, like, confusing my guests over here?
No, we had that's right.
This guy was on Mulholland Drive.
Mulholland
you can't
Drive,
make,
yes.
You can't make stuff like that.
Oh, man.
Anybody in that movie, they're in, like, a special club.
Know,
no,
right.
Tomorrow People just ended.
Tomorrow People.
Yeah, he was the lead on that, or one of the leads on that show.
God
and
damn.
Then, Yeah, well, Lee saves those kind of things for the end of the interview.
I do, that's right.
Weren't you in Jaws?
Yeah, that's right.
Weren't you in Jaws?
Oh, man.
I was in Jaws 3.
Yeah.
I almost said Red Heat because we were talking about Red Heat earlier.
I would love it if Mark was in Jaws 3. He wanted to be a marine biologist because of Jaws 3. That was Dennis Quaid's character in Jaws 3. He was a marine biologist.
That's right.
That's true.
I forgot that he was in
that
movie.
You know, one of the reasons I also didn't become a marine biologist is because I saw Jaws when it came out in theaters, and it scared me so bad I was actually afraid. afraid to scuba dive and go in the water.
You know, all those people, so, though, that were afraid of Jaws after Jaws 1, did they get unafraid of it after Jaws 3? Were they like, what was that bullshit I was going through?
You know what? I'm going
swimming.
Yeah,
and Michael Caine's in it. It's in the car.
Oh, that's Jaws 4.
That's Jaws
4.
The Revenge.
Oh,
Jaws the Revenge.
That's even worse. Oh, that's when Jaws goes after the kids.
Yes. David Krumholtz. Yeah, serial killer Jaws.
Yeah, where he follows
Jaws
from...
Yeah,
to
Jaws
Florida.
Followed him to Florida. He kills Brody's kids.
Right.
One by one.
Right.
And Lorraine Gary.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. No, this is true. And Lorraine Gary's, like, having nightmares about Jaws.
Right.
And Michael Caine plays, like, her lover.
Right.
Now, David Krumholtz and I, we were talking about this yesterday.
He gets out of the water and his shirt's immediately dried.
It's so funny you guys brought this up. And before I let Mark go, I got asked about the Big Lebowski. But Krumholtz and I, we were talking about this yesterday. And I reminded Krumholtz because he's like, yeah, you know, Michael Caine does everything from Jaws to a Woody Allen movie, Hannah and Her Sisters. So he takes everything, and that's how I kind of look at myself. And I go, but don't forget, David, when he did Hannah and her sisters, he got nominated for an Academy Award and won. He could not accept the award because he was filming Jaws 4.
Right.
So, win some, lose some.
Relegating his work strictly to the stuff in the 80s.
Yeah, right.
And Jaws 3 was when Jaws somehow got into SeaWorld.
That was SeaWorld, right? Jaws.
Yeah. What was Jaws 2?
Jaws 2 was basically...
Oh, my God.
It was more of the same.
That was basically the remake of the first
one.
Hold
on. Which one was it where he died? One of them he dies with the... Wait, Jaws 1 was where he dies with, like, the big, like, oxygen tank.
Yeah.
And then Jaws 2 is when he dies by fighting in the electrical line.
Yes. And Roy Scheider did not want to come back for Jaws 2, and Universal said, if you don't come back, we're going to fuck you, and we're going to fuck you hard. And he's like, fucking come back, whatever.
All right.
Because Roy Scheider was the best. That's one of my actors I loved. That was one of
I loved him. He was great.
Yeah, he's the best. I got to ask about Big Lebowski before I let you go. Yeah. Obviously, small role, but you're in the Big Lebowski, so it doesn't really fucking matter. Do you get... I mean, first of all, there's, like, cult members in the Big Lebowski. Do they, like, confront you and, like, bother you at all? And what was it like doing that film?
To the first question, sure, yeah. People love that film in a very passionate way, and you know, they'll always be like, you're the guy who pissed on the rug. No, I'm not. Woo pissed on the rug, man. I didn't piss on the rug. but, yeah, it was fun working on that movie. You know, I didn't know it was going to be as the big cult hit that it's become, but it was really, really cool working with those guys. You know, Ethan and Joel are just really down-to-earth guys and really accessible, and everybody on the film was really accessible. Jeff was.
Have you done a Lebowski?
Jeff was. I love watching Jeff. I haven't done any of those Lebowski. I've been invited to a couple of them, but I've been working at the time, and I haven't gone. But I'm planning on visiting one of these things soon.
I was going to say, Mark, when you go, I'll go. Let me know when you're going.
Let's go.
I'll go.
You'll show
I want
up.
To.
We'll bring a Chinese guy to pee on something.
We'll bring a woo.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when they started Lebowski Fest, I was like, I just turned 17 or 18, and I really wanted to go. My parents wouldn't let me.
Jesus, that's been a long time,
yeah,
I think.
It's been going 14, 15 years.
Christ.
And they, at the beginning, it was just literally like 100, 200 guys. And they would meet at a bowling alley somewhere in the country in a drive-in movie theater. At the drive-in, they would show Big Lebowski.
And they would do math
in
the lot.
To the bowling
something
alley
the dude
afterwards.
Would never do.
Right. And then afterwards, you go to the bowling alley and have all you can drink, the
White Russians,
and bowl. Uh-huh. And now there's like thousands of people that go. It's grown that big.
I kind of respect that because there aren't those kinds of cults swarming around movies anymore like there were in the 70s.
No, I love
very
it.
Few.
I love it.
I just hope they don't ever make a sequel and ruin it like they did Boondock Saints.
Yeah. Mark, are you, like, what is your thought on indie film nowadays? I mean, obviously, everyone, in order to do independent film, has to take a huge pay cut nowadays compared to what it was in the late 90s, early 2000s.
But they want a really good, juicy part, maybe.
But is that something that you are interested in because you could get a juicier role or a more interesting project?
Oh, yeah, man. I love that. I think you know that's where the imagination is in these independent films, and where somebody's going to see you not in the box that the studio wants to put you in, but, you know, for maybe something that you're even more right for that nobody else could imagine you in. I love that. I'm dying to do more independent films.
Well, that's great. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us. I think Nick Searcy's calling. We're literally going to be going from Mark to Nick. We're just, no bumper here, nothing. Mark Pellegrino, you're the best brother. And anytime
thank you, man. So are you.
Yeah, anything you got to promote, come on. Come on board.
You got it. You guys,
thank you.
You guys are great. Thank you so much, man.
Thanks,
yeah, man.
Bye, Mark.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Those were some great stories.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, sometimes when we have two guests, I'm like, well, now the other guest is fucked. He's never going to top this, but it's Searcy.
It's Nick.
So
yeah.
odds are he'll
just
match up pretty well.
I'm still curious to find out if he tipped the Uber driver.
Oh, seriously? let me see if this is Nick.
We'll
actually
see. He probably
Nick?
Just hogtied something.
I don't know.
No one follows Nick Searcy. No one.
Listen, that's why you were second. We had the main eventer.
We wouldn't put you before anyone.
I'm the Jerry Lee Lewis of podcasts. No one can follow me.
I got to tell you, Nick has been doing like 50 podcasts this week. I'm a little jealous. I'm like, oh, man, he's getting out there now.
Yeah.
Everybody in the world's got a podcast with him.
Doing like a cooking show.
Yeah, right.
Gardening.
I'd watch a Nick Searcy cooking show.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
When are we getting more acting school with Nick Searcy, Nick?
Just fucking put it in the oven.
Well, you know, I've got so many other things going on right now, and that's kind of why, because that's acting school is kind of like, it's a one-man production, or maybe me and another guy, but I never give him any credit, so it's all me. So I've got to finish up some of the other things before I can get back to that. And also, I'm basically, there's a couple of people I'm talking to about, you know, actually putting it on a network and making other people pay for it. So
that's
really
interesting.
But for some reason, you know, Hollywood has not warmly embraced the idea of some old guy making fun of Hollywood. They just haven't jumped on that for some reason.
So you're saying that all those liberals in Hollywood are very sensitive. They're very sensitive.
Apparently so. I seem to have made some of them mad, but
yeah.
Well, you do have 5150 Mall Cop coming out, or is that out right now? 5150 Mall Cop. Pat doesn't give me the information. Is that out? How come I haven't seen it?
Yes, it was released yesterday on every digital platform. Oh. You know, iTunes and Amazon and everything, and also a few other ways that I'm not. It's on video on demand. You can buy it through Redbox, through Target. It's in Walmart. You know, it's like out finally, but it's not in theaters. It's only on DVD and digital.
I gotta tell you, no one does more PR lately than Nick Searcy. I see him on Fox News. He's doing Dana Loesch. He's doing all these shows lately. What, are you just like getting a million phone calls to do stuff? It's like people just decided Justified's amazing.
He's best baking a cake on the Today Show.
Yeah, what is going on? You are everywhere, brother.
Well, you know, a lot of this publicity I'm doing now is for 5150 Mall Cop because the director's a friend of mine. He called me up and he says, I'm not getting anybody to do any publicity. Would you do some? And I said, sure, I'll do a little. You know, so it's kind of like that. But I'm also kind of like, you know, I wind up getting on Fox News a lot for some reason. I finally figured out I may be the only guy in Hollywood that will even speak to anybody at Fox News.
No, you're not. You know, there are more.
No, who else goes on Fox News, though?
Well, none of them do, but
right,
there are more people
that's
who will
point.
Speak to them, like James Woods and Drew Carey.
But Mikey and I, we were talking about this, I think, last week. Nick's the only, like, conservative guy in Hollywood that'll go out there and be conservative. And be, I mean, I'd say Dennis Miller, but he doesn't really do anything outside of his radio show and Fox.
Right.
He's not acting in anything.
Yeah.
Nick's actually acting and still going out there and talking about the issues.
I got to give it up for you. That does take some balls, really, because it really is kind of one-sided out there.
Well, I'll give you a great example of something that Nick nails, okay? This whole hashtag bring back our girls thing, Nick's totally on point with that argument. Nick, why don't we talk about this? Bring back our girls. Hashtag. Is that going to do it? If we just are they going to come back?
Like, as if they think that's going to be they've done it now. We all hashtagged about it. We said bring back our girls, and now we feel real good about ourselves because we care. And now it's over.
Yeah, right. And they're going to release all those girls they kidnapped in Africa because we hashtagged bring back our girls.
Does anybody in this country realize that half the people in Africa don't have internet access, don't know what a hashtag is? And the few people that do know that probably have these girls in caption are probably laughing and going, look at these stupid Americans.
Yeah. Hush.
Because it really is. It's all about feeling good about yourself. That so much of what happens on the left, or at least, I mean, not the hard political left, but sort of the, what I call them, the casual left or the default
left. The limousine
left.
Yeah.
Who doesn't, they don't think about it very much. Most of that is just about feeling good about yourself, you know? Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm for poor people eating, so I feel good about being for that, because, and I'm a liberal now. And, you know, it's that sort of shallowness that bugs me.
Because you know what's funny is inherently, as much as on the surface it looks like they're doing a good thing, it's almost like an oxymoron. It's like you're trying to do something from somebody else when you're really doing it for yourself. It's just,
that's the definition of charity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. And Nick was just on Bill O'Reilly because Nick, you were supporting that this movie about Kermit Gosnell, the abortion doctor in Philadelphia, right, Nick? I want to make sure I get this right. I'm not a news guy. Philadelphia,
yeah,
correct?
He was convicted of murder, and he operated out of Philadelphia for a number of years, like about three decades.
Hundreds and hundreds of unborn children, all these things. He killed all these children. No one wanted this movie to get made. You guys went out and got the funding for it. And even Bill O'Reilly says he can't watch a movie about Kermit Gosnell. Why is this movie so important to you?
Well, it's a story that, you know, I mean, the filmmakers, they want to make it because they just think it's a compelling story. I mean, and it is fascinating. Just look at it. It's like, really, this guy was able to operate all these years under the noses of government officials and other doctors recommending patients go to him, and this sort of horror was going on? I mean, it really is fascinating, not just about, you know, what a monster that guy was, but just for how long it was able to go on and in a way just sort of be endorsed by the community. And that's really what interested me about it. And I think that's what's important about it, is that, you know, how does this happen? Because it wasn't just unborn babies. Some of these babies were born alive and literally out in the womb alive, and he killed them.
Yeah.
You know? And it's sort of this, how did we get to a place where a mindset can exist obviously an educated man, that it was okay for him to do that? I mean, how did he get to that point?
See, but this is why I think it's great. This is what Kickstarter and Indiegogo, this is what these things are perfect for. Because this is a movie Hollywood would never make.
No.
One, there's three terms right away why Hollywood would never make this: abortion, politics, race.
Right.
Right there, three, and it's not 12 Years a Slave. So it's three terms right there.
It's not coddling people.
That they're like, nope, we're never making this movie. Not a chance in hell. And that's what's great about these Kickstarters. And that's why I think Spike Lee doing a Kickstarter and Zach Braff, it's bullshit, because you're not making anything that's really worth making off of taking people's money. We should be making stuff off of Indiegogo and Kickstarter that wouldn't get made by Hollywood.
That wouldn't get made, and it should be in the spirit of do it yourself.
Yeah, and this
it shouldn't
is what
just
this
be
is.
Another joint by Spike Lee.
Yeah, right. So
I applaud
you.
Well, the thing that's great about the Indiegogo stuff is that Hollywood isn't the gatekeepers anymore. You know, there's a way that you can go directly to the audience and say, we think you want to see this film. What do you think? And they can put their money down if they want to, or not.
That's true, and you're gonna.
You don't have to run it by every studio head in Hollywood anymore. You can make your own movie now.
Another person that supported this movie about Kermit Gosnell, who is also a friend of the show, is Kevin Sorbo, who I absolutely love, and he's a really smart man. I mean, so there are people that are recognizing how important of a movie this could be and that it should get made. So that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's well, now they've raised the money. You know, we were successful getting the money. And I told Phelim and Ann that what they should do now is just take off and go just spend the money and go live on an island somewhere. And I'll start another Indiegogo campaign about the scam of the century, Indiegogo. And we'll make a move about them stealing all the money and not making the move.
That's good. Do you know Bill O'Reilly outside of his show? Have you had any experience with him outside of the show?
No, I have not. I've been to Fox News a couple of times, and I know Greg Gutfeld a little bit, and I'm pretty good friends with Dana Perino, and because they're both really big Justified fans. But
yeah.
No, I've never encountered Bill, and I still haven't met him because that time I was on the show, I was in Raleigh, North Carolina, in a studio, and he was in New York. So.
Right. Well, the headquarters, I imagine, is like a gloomy castle on a mountaintop.
It is. It looks a lot like the castle in Young Frankenstein.
Because I noticed it was satellite with Bill, and then my thought on it was, even when you and Bill were kind of going toe-to-toe about this movie, I'm like, oh, that seems pretty real. Like, these guys either know each other really well or don't know each other at all. And I think that's kind of cool that Bill's like that. Listen, I don't dislike Bill O'Reilly at all.
Really?
No, I don't.
While I was sitting there getting ready to do the show, you know, you're listening to it in the earpiece and it's all going on. And you start to realize, you know, it's okay. He does 3 minutes on the guy whose ranch is being stormed by the government. And then he moves on to this. And then he comes to, and then he's got Nick Searcy about this. And he just got to go from topic to topic.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to have some respect for that. It's a hard job.
He's got to fill up an hour, and I don't even know if he's still doing his radio show, but there was a point in time where he was doing the Bill O'Reilly show, and then he was doing The Factor, which was his radio show, and he was doing that like 4 hours a day. And, I mean, I used to listen to Bill here and there. I'm not a big Sean Hannity guy. Sean Hannity's the guy I don't like.
Yeah. He kind of sounds like you know, the guys from the Charlie Murphy, like the parents that are talking in the background.
Sean is not my favorite, but Bill's all right. And you know who I like a lot, whose show you do a lot, Dana Loesch. I like her a lot.
Oh, yeah, she's just a joy. She's a lot of fun, and she's really whip smart, and it's always great to talk to her. She's doing really well for herself. I mean,
she's not Bill Maher's favorite person. I know that. I know Bill Maher's not a huge fan.
Yeah. Well, and Piers Morgan really was never – she got the best of him many times.
I remember that. Piers Morgan, though, that was a guy who had a show on CNN. Piers is an interesting personality, but he's not really educated to the point where he should be talking about all the things he was talking about.
But he has a British accent, man.
Yeah, right.
Come on.
Right.
He clearly knows.
I don't think Piers knew everything he's talking about.
He sounded really smart, though. Those British people, they just sound so smart.
Don't they?
I still think one of the best episodes of the Piers Morgan show was when he had Alex Jones on.
Oh, he couldn't get a word in.
And Alex just starts laying into him. I was rolling.
Yeah.
That was some great TV.
Yeah,
it was great TV, and I actually have a soft spot in my heart for Alex, although he really doesn't make himself look good when he gets on mainstream shows.
I thought you were going to say you have a soft spot for Piers. I'm like, well, okay.
No. No.
Yeah.
No, go ahead. What were you saying, Nick? You never did Pierce's show. He didn't call you.
No, I didn't. I was going to say that Pierce is one big soft spot, but that's all.
Right. He's a huge Justified fan, though, probably. Isn't he?
Everyone's a Justified fan. I love how everyone jumped on this Justified bandwagon after, like...
Like every other show,
the show's
people
the
discover
Wire.
It.
It's The Wire.
Season 5, when people start discovering it, like The Wire or Breaking Bad.
No, it's true. Hey. Nick will tell you they had their highest ratings this year out of any year.
Well, yeah. It really is, like, the best show on TV, I gotta say, Nick. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks. I mean, it really... I love it. You know, it's really one of the luckiest things that's ever happened to me, just to sort of be able to be a part of it. I mean... It's a great bunch of writers and actors, you know, except for Oliphant, who's really just he's a terrible human being. But everybody else is fine.
Just a posturing punk who got the job, yeah.
Can I ask you a controversial question, Nick? Who's a bigger racist, Donald Sterling or Al Sharpton?
Well, you know, obviously the NAACP couldn't decide. They were going to award both of them.
Yeah, right. Right. Wait, they both received multiple awards. Let's get that straight.
Yeah, right.
I mean, shouldn't they just call that racist of the year? I mean, if they're going to give it to those guys, you know, that should be the name of the award, you know. The whole Sterling thing is like, it really, you know, what he said was disturbing, but it's like, are we going to just go around taping everybody talking to their girlfriends or something,
yeah.
You know, and then, look at what this guy said. I mean, it's just
We are, Nick.
It just seems so shocking that was even news, you know.
Yeah, Illinois just recently passed a law saying you can record your phone conversations.
Nobody knew this was a law.
It's new, and now everyone knows. Well, now still nobody knows about it.
I wouldn't be surprised if this conversation was being recorded.
Illinois has a habit of passing a lot of laws like that, and somehow they get no press coverage.
No,
this is the same state we're talking about where the government officials can drive through red lights, but if you stop and make a turn at a red light, they will send you a ticket.
The red light thing with Rahm is really sticking in your craw, huh?
Not just Rahm. Tori Periwinkle as well.
Yeah, Tony Preckwinkle, the Amazon woman.
Yeah.
The
Amazon woman. She's like 6'7". She's huge.
That's hot. I think that's hot.
I mean, she's. I had dinner with her.
I don't know if you've seen Tony then.
She's,
I wouldn't say that.
She's very intelligent. She seems like a very, very smart woman.
I would go up
huge.
On her. I would go up on her.
Yeah, right. You would go up. No, everyone that knows me knows that I hate the politics in the city of Chicago.
Yeah.
Rahm Emanuel, I think, is maybe the most irresponsible politician in the country.
I agree.
He's really bad. I mean, he makes Jerry Brown look okay.
He's like that evil guy from that superhero movie that, like, is the mayor of a city that's, behind closed doors is, like, an alien that, like, has, like, a plot to take over the world.
Yeah.
Okay, Alex Jones.
Well, let's get an idea of this, because we know what the problems are with Rahm. We've talked about him on the show. Nick, you live in California with Jerry Brown as your governor and with Eric Garcetti as your mayor. What is politics like in L.A., like, local politics?
You know, it's funny. I live in Burbank, which is a separate community. So it's I can't even vote in L.A. city elections. So it's like we have our own government, and it's much less crazy and
you have a
much
Burbank
less
government.
Yeah.
Bob Hope was your mayor at one point.
But it's just over the hill.
Yeah. Well, we're big Burbank fans.
Oh, yeah.
On this show.
Well, it's great here. But the things about Los Angeles, I mean – It's almost like the whole state is run by lunatics. I mean, with Jerry Brown, it's like they cannot figure out this thing about runaway production. You know that everything that used to shoot in California is now shooting in Detroit and in New Orleans and in Atlanta, and they can't figure out that it's the taxes that are the problem. You know,
it is
so every time more business leaves, their only solution is to raise taxes again.
I'll tell you a funny thing. It's funny you brought that up. I'm fighting for the company that I'm making my show with. I want them to film it in Chicago. And they're like, oh, that's true, probably tax purposes. And I'm like the only person ever that's wanted to film it outside of L.A. because I don't want to be in L.A. Like, I want to be in Chicago. They thought I was, like, getting out of L.A. because of taxes. I'm like, yeah, that's what it is. Yeah.
He's smart, that man.
Yeah, I'm smart. I'm smart like that.
Yeah, and you know, the thing about Los Angeles is, though, everybody gripes about the government, and then, you know, you walk outside your house at 9:30 in the morning, and it's like 75 degrees, and the birds are chirping, and you just go, it's not so bad.
Yeah, right. That's kind of what it is. I mean, I love Burbank. I love the Valley. We are actually This is once again where Nick and I are different than most people in L.A., where
the Valley.
Not just politics, but the Valley is where we like.
Yeah, I don't like going over the hill. I go over there as little as possible. You know?
Yes,
but
absolutely.
It's more, you know, Burbank is more like it's just a suburban town. It could be anywhere. It just happens to be it's a suburb of the film industry, you know.
Yeah, right. Nick, have you ever heard back from Sean Penn after you told him to shove his Oscar up his ass?
Because Sean Penn, it's, you know,
it's already one up there.
Did you ever hear back?
Well, you know, that was years ago. That was
well,
probably.
Well, I've given Sean a lot of time to respond to you. That's why I'm asking now.
Well, I did receive a message from Sean Penn through a mutual friend, which did surprise me. I won't say who the mutual friend was, but you'd know his name. But anyway, he called me to ask me about something else, and he had just done a movie with Sean, and he said, oh, by the way, you know, Sean was talking about you, and he told me to give you a message. And I said, oh, really? What did he say? And he said, he told me to tell you that he thought you were fantastic in The Dead Girl, which was a movie I did with Karen Moncrief directing it. And I said, really? That's all he said? He said, yeah, that's it. He just told me to tell you he thought you were really good in that. And I said, well, okay, that's great. Tell him I said thanks. So that's the last. And that was probably 10 years after I had told him where to put the Oscar. So.
Well, that's kind of classy on Sean's part, I guess. I mean, it's a little better than Kevin Nash challenging you to a fight.
It's a lot classier than I would have been, Matthew. I'll tell you, I'm not a very classy person.
Well, we've all seen acting school with Nick Searcy. We know you're not that classy.
Yeah,
right.
You're taking handicapped people's spots. You're fighting Stephen Root.
Yeah, but he's doing it in a classy way.
Right.
Now wait a minute. That Brian Anderson, that handicapped guy, tried to take my parking space.
I still think one of my favorite bits on acting school at Nick Searcy is where Nick Searcy has his hoes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The bitches.
The bitches.
I call
right.
them bitches. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. I die when I watch acting school with Nick Searcy.
My favorite thing I've ever done with them is when we do the thing about lunchtime and we're on the set at Justified and the guy comes up and goes, here, Mr. Searcy, we have a new script. And I go, I don't read that. Give that to my bitches.
Oh my god, that's so funny. By the way, Nick Searcy missed our Jim Ross interview last week, so I'm giving you a heads up, Nick. June 5th.
Oh wow.
It's me, Victoria, and DDP. Are you going to call in?
Wow.
Oh, I will try to call in. I'll try not to.
I'm going to remind you. It's DDP. Come on.
Wow.
That's going to be a good show.
One of the things I'm working on right now, one of the projects that has kept me away from acting school is that for the last year I've been working on this show about independent wrestlers. And I went to Georgia last summer and shot for about a week with a wrestler named Mickey Gotti, who's kind of my partner in this. And we've been sort of pitching the show about, you know, aspiring wrestlers in Georgia. And we finally got some traction on it about a couple months ago. This company, Magilla Entertainment in New York, they do Long Island Medium and Moonshiners. They're a pretty successful reality show company. They kind of have taken us on, and we're going to be in the next 2-3 weeks, we're pitching the show.
It's a good time, too, because Billy Corgan's independent wrestling show just sold, too. So, I mean, No, this is true. Billy Corgan has a wrestling company in Chicago called Resistance Pro, and they're doing a reality show on AMC about the behind the scenes of this indie wrestling promotion.
Oh, shit.
But Nick has a different spin with his show. His show's totally different, but I think, like, especially off the heels of the Corgan show, you would definitely should be taking meetings on that now. That's smart.
Yeah, I mean, and the show that we've got is definitely way different than what Billy's doing. Ours is much more about who these people are, who does this, you know, who are these people that want to be wrestlers and also work in carpet mills and garages and do all this other stuff during the week, and then on the weekends they're $25-$50 a match. They're dropping each other on their heads, and they, you know, long to be in the WWE. I mean, that to me, that's always fascinated me because I always wanted to be in the WWE. I just didn't want to lift all those weights.
Well,
and also, I found the sort of grabbing sweaty men and rolling around really distasteful. But other than that, I really wanted to be in the WWE.
Well, and it's funny, too, because I see you've been hanging out. You hung out with Matt Hardy. I know you and Matt Hardy became friends, and John Morrison, and, like, all these guys that you're meeting and stuff. So you definitely are getting to enjoy your hobby of wrestling, that's for sure.
Yeah, and hopefully, you know, if this show, you know, takes off, I mean, I'm hoping that it will. And I'm kind of confident that it will. I mean, it'll give me a chance to do some other stuff because Matt Hardy and I are talking about doing some things together and you know, some other things peripherally. I'm a serious wrestling fan.
So are we saying that Nick Searcy may be stepping into a wrestling ring?
Yes, we are saying that.
That is some news.
It may not need to be a wrestler.
Well,
I may be other than a wrestler, but I might be stepping into a ring for sure.
So you may be the new Paul Heyman or Bobby Heenan.
Well, that would be great. I love Paul Heyman. I think Paul Heyman is a genius. And really, he's been around forever. I mean, I remember him when he was Johnny Dangerously. Or Paulie Dangerously.
Paulie Dangerously, and he had the giant cell phone, and he would crack it over people's skulls, and it was great.
Right. You
remember the Clash of the Champions where he had Jason Hervey on from the Wonder Years, and he interviewed Jason Hervey, and he took this huge cell phone, one of those Zach Morris cell phones, I call them, from Saved by the Bell, and he cracks it over his head, and it busts in half, and I go, that's the greatest wrestling angle I've seen on TV in forever. That was great.
No, that's great. He's still a genius. I mean, he still cracks me up. You know, I love that he will not shut up about Brock Lesnar beating The Undertaker. He just never shuts up about that. That is hilarious.
Hey, I wouldn't shut up about it either if that was on my list of wins either. You know, the thing I love about Nick is I could see him being like James E. Cornette meets Paulie Dangerously. That's what I see. I see a little James Cornette in you, too.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what Matt Hardy and I are talking about. We're trying to figure out exactly, you know, because if I do something like that, I want to do it with respect for the business, and you know, I want to do it and respect what Matt's doing, and you know, we're just trying to figure out a way to unleash international film and television star Nick Searcy into the wrestling ring. So,
I love it. I think that's great. I love that. What else was I going to ask you? Oh, I was thinking about this the other day, and I go, you know who the person is I really want who his opinion on is Nick Searcy. How politically correct is this country getting, and is it getting a little too over the top? Like, for me, it's getting – okay, I'll tell you my example. This is how it came up in my head and why I wanted to ask you. Fat shaming. I keep hearing people use the term slut shaming and fat shaming, and I keep imagining only people that get mad about this are really far left liberals and fat people and sluts. Like, the only people getting mad about the term slut shaming are sluts. Am I crazy here?
Well, yeah, it's like I've been accused of fat shaming because I do this thing on Twitter where I call people fat. You know, like on Twitter, it's like that's sort of my when somebody calls me a racist on Twitter, I just start calling them fat. You know, and they just go, how dare you? You know, how do you know that I'm fat? And I go, well, it's this really neat new Twitter fat sensing software that I have. Obviously, I know that you're fat, just like you know that I'm a racist. So.
Yeah, I always find it fascinating when people nick a racist on Twitter. I'm like, oh my god, you guys know nothing about this guy.
Oh, that's the go-to. That's the go-to when you're having like a liberal political conversation.
Yeah,
you could be like, the sky's blue, you're a racist.
Listen, I've met a lot of racists though, and they tend to kind of look like Nick. Come on.
Yeah, but.
Well, I mean, I've made a lot of money playing racist, so, you know, obviously.
Yeah, there you go.
I'll tell you, the two best things, though, Nick did when it came to Twitter was, one, his fight with Kevin Nash, which is epic, and two, the video you made apologizing for calling people fat on Twitter to Randy Newman's short people, and he did it fat people. And it was
fat
the
liberals.
Greatest thing ever. Fat liberals. Fat liberals got nobody. No, it's good. It's good. People don't know that Nick can play the piano. He covered the entire
Thank You for Being a Friend.
The entire Thank You for Being a Friend.
While singing.
On Acting School with Nick Searcy. Yeah. Not just the first 45 seconds.
And he could sing.
Right.
And did the whole song. Yeah, I had a band in college.
That's great. Stephen Root wasn't in that band, I take it.
No.
No?
No. Actually, the guitarist in my band in college is now John Mellencamp's lead guitarist, has been for 15 years.
Wow. Jeez. Funny how that works out. That's kind of crazy. But, yeah, he did Fat Liberals, which you got to check out if you got YouTube or on Twitter. It's the funniest thing I've seen.
You know, I think that all this PC stuff is really just people looking to be offended. It's like they see some angle in it. It's like I can either shut down debate or I can brand this person as some sort of awful person if I can find something that he said to be offended about. You know, and it's gotten ridiculous. It's like I can't even keep up with it. There was some big scandal about somebody named Micklemore.
Oh, Macklemore, he dressed up in long curly hair with long sideburns. He put on a fake prosthetic nose that had, it was a hook shape. He put on big glasses with fat rims. And he played a song basically about being like petty and like cheap. Uh-huh. And so everyone's like, oh, he's doing an impression of Jews. And it's really, really offensive. And people are really offended. And Rod Lurie and I got into a fight on Facebook about this. And I go, Rod, he may not necessarily be a bigot or a racist. He may just be an idiot. He may just think that it was funny, and it just wasn't funny.
Was he trying to be funny?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. He claims it was a mistake, and he just picked those things randomly to wear.
Well, that's
doesn't help him at all.
That's horseshit.
Yeah,
if he was performing as a funny, like as a comedic performance, then it's not racist.
Like I said to Rod Lurie, I go, listen, if anyone but Mel Brooks did Blazing Saddles, it's probably a racist, poor taste movie.
Right.
You got to be a genius to pull that off. And by the way, no one's calling Mel Brooks a racist.
No, and no one remembers that he hired Richard Pryor to write the movie with him.
Right.
Stupid.
Well, you know, it's funny. I just went to a screening out here of Blazing Saddles that Mel Brooks spoke in front of. It was during the TCM Film Festival out here, and somebody in the audience asked him, you know, would you make this movie today? And he said, there's no way in hell you could make this movie.
Yeah,
no way.
No.
I think a lot of these issues where they start going after people, I mean, it becomes like a popularity contest. Like, what's the popular issue today that we can all get good press out of?
I'll tell you something. I think political correctness has kind of receded a little bit.
I'm going to
disagree with you guys. I think you guys would all say it's been steadily coming up year after year. I think it ebbs and flows. I think with the rise of success of people like Sarah Silverman, success of movies like The Aristocrats, I think an anti-PC tide starts to come in, and then it recedes. That's kind of
Here's
what I
Here's my argument. You know who you just named? You talked about Sarah Silverman, and you talked about The Aristocrats. Being anti-PC is only okay when you're uber-liberal. It's just the truth. Like, someone knows you're a Republican and you make an anti-PC joke, you're a racist. If Sarah Silverman makes a black joke, she's funny. And I'd love to hear you try to argue on that.
Comedians get a pass that other people don't get.
I don't think so. I think everyone gets that pass.
No.
Funny's funny.
Yeah, funny is
You don't have to be a stand-up comedian to get a pass on a funny joke.
I just think that early 90s form of PC where you have to say certain things and can't say other things, I don't think it's quite that extreme as when it arrived on the scene.
Do you read Jezebel or anything all this fat shaming and slut shaming?
I think to a degree it's integrated into media more, but I think regular citizens don't regard it. I think more people say black than African-American than they used to. I'm talking
they're
about
not
regular,
even Africans. They're just fucking American.
I'm talking about, yes, obviously. I'm with you on that. But, like, I think regular people, I think it's receded.
Okay,
the
media
is one thing, but but you got to understand the mainstream press and the media and the tabloids. That's not a depiction.
This Macklemore thing was a huge deal, though. So it's not just the media. The media gets upset about, but a ton of people get upset about it. It's the number one trending thing on
Twitter. Well, if Sacha Baron Cohen made that music video, it'd be hilarious.
By the way, Sacha Baron Cohen does Borat, which is a Jewish joke after Jewish joke after Jewish joke. Okay.
Why do you have to? Why do you have to be a comedian to actually say
that's what I'm saying? That's my point, and that's what I get pissed off at is as long as you're only if you're a comedian or your politics are known that you're like super liberal and like you accept everybody, then you could make racist or any kind of jokes that are like politically correct.
Yes, I agree that it's all context. All right.
Listen, it's just what I've noticed.
I need to open a beer.
Nick seriously has a way better opinion on this than we do because Nick is openly conservative on Twitter. So he could tell you, make a joke, Nick, and are people okay when you make a politically incorrect joke?
Well, you know, I don't know that I make that many of them. You know, I mean, my jokes are politically incorrect only in the sense that they're not liberal orthodoxy. You know, I tend to make fun of Al Sharpton and Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, you know, a lot. And I don't really do it in a racial context except to say that, you know, you're calling me a racist and yet you're watching Al Sharpton on MSNBC. I mean,
right.
Give me a break, you know. I mean, my jokes tend to be more, you know, I'm kind of sensitive about the racial thing, too, just because my family's multiracial.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very conscious of that sort of thing, but yeah, I mean the closest thing I think I've gotten to be you know called out for being politically incorrect is the fat shaming thing. You know they're always going Nick Searcy's a fat shamer, and I just write him back and go, you must be really fat. You're obviously very sensitive about it.
Yeah, I mean that's a big thing. Like you can't make fat jokes now. I mean,
that was the last one. Remember, that was the last thing
really
you could make
right
fun
now.
Of.
It's really hot right now that you can't.
Remember Austin Powers? That was like the last thing where it was like you could laugh at a fat person that I can remember.
By the way, 5150 Mall Cops, Nick's new film. It's on iTunes right now, video on demand, all that kind of good stuff. You can check out 5150 Mall Cop.
Shot 12 years ago. The great thing about it is it was shot 12 years ago, so
I was
you can imagine how good I look. I look
I was
so young.
Nick Searcy has hair in this film.
I have so much hair that I can actually comb it from one side of my head all the way to the other side.
That's good. I mean, I could see in the trailer, I'm like, oh, Nick has hair. All right, so they use some kind of wig or something in this toupee. All right.
Oh, that's bald shaming.
Yeah, I'm sorry, bald shaming.
Bald shaming.
From a bald, coming from a bald guy.
Yeah.
Coming from two bald guys.
What I'm trying to bring in is a new term called fat priding.
I've been doing that my whole life.
Yeah. Yeah, Mikey is all about the fat pride.
Yeah.
If you're trying to make people be proud of how fat they are, you're endangering their life. That's a little worse.
Nick, I remember when I was 16 years old, and I was at the nurse weighed me, and I was at the doctor visit, and I was a junior in high school, so I was like 315, 320, and she like weighs me, and she like doesn't tell me what my weight is. I'm like, well, how much do I weigh? Oh, it's okay. I'm like,
it's okay.
No, I want to know how much I weigh, and she like I had to like get it out of her. I'm like, hot damn, I'm going for 330 next visit, and she like gave me this look of terror. It was incredible.
Classic Mikey.
By the way, Mikey, ask Nick, did he tip the Uber guy?
Oh yeah, Nick, I gotta tell you, because I was talking to Maddie about this. Maddie's like, he's gonna tip the Uber guy when he gets back. I'm like, he's not supposed to tip the Uber guy. He's like, he's gonna tip him. So when you got back to the hotel, did you tip him or did you just get out and get your bags?
I tipped him.
So the guy got two tips.
You were right, Maddie. You were right.
I just know Nick's a classy guy.
Hey, I appreciate the hell out of it, but the Uber guy was probably like, what the hell's going on?
I'm a public figure. I'm an international film and television star. I can't have somebody going around going, he stiffed me.
Yeah, Peabody Award winners can't not.
Well, in the future, just so you know,
it was a Polk Award.
When it comes to Ubers, that's tied into a credit card for whoever like calls the car, and a 20% tip, and the charge is already included in all that. So we'll save you the trouble next time. But you're a good
okay,
man.
Well,
you know what I like? The Uber guy took the tip.
Of course he did.
The Uber guy took the tip and didn't say, oh, Mr. Searcy, it was already taken care of. No, no, no. He said, oh, yeah, this is where you tip me, yes.
Well, that's the difference between Chicago and L.A.
actually, what he said when I tipped him was like, $2, that's it?
Oh, that's great.
And you were like, do you know who I am?
Right. You can tell people you drove me around in your car.
Oh, that's great. What other projects you got going on right now, Nick? You got other stuff coming up? Justified goes back to shooting when? Like September, August?
Yeah, we start shooting again in October.
Okay.
Like I said, right now, I finished a film that's going to come out probably around the start of football season, I think, this year, September. It's a movie called Greater. Is the name of it, and it's an independent film, a true story about Brandon Burlsworth, who was a football player at the University of Arkansas back in the late 90s, and it's a really, really interesting and sort of powerful story, and that's going to be coming out around football season. And what else? I've got a little part in this TV movie, Petals in the Wind, that Lifetime is putting on. I think it premieres next week sometime.
I may miss that.
That
one
is
next.
A Lifetime title.
I mean, I hope my audience of wrestling fans and beer drinkers go rush to see it. But
against Lifetime, but I love that they still make movies with Lifetime titles.
Yeah. Well, this was actually Karen Moncrief directed this, and Karen's an old friend, and she directed The Dead Girl, which made Sean Penn sort of send me a message and forgive me for telling him to cram the Oscar up his ass. So, you know, everything comes full circle in a way.
Yeah.
By the way, my favorite fat-shaming Nick Searcy tweet was some girl tried to hit Nick Searcy with a zinger on Twitter about how somebody had more followers than Nick. And Nick responded, the only reason he has more followers is my strict weight limit. No fat asses.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That is good.
Yeah,
that's my favorite.
My Twitter feed is not pretty, ladies and gentlemen. No. If you come on my Twitter feed, it's a bloodbath. That's
no,
just
Nick,
be warned.
Nick Searcy's the white 50-year-old Kevin Hart. So,
That's good.
That's good.
Nick, when we last saw you at the Squared Circle when we were in Chicago, you were filming something where you were had a couple scenes as a vampire patriarch. How did that all turn out?
That's right. Well, I haven't heard from those guys. I think they're still shooting, actually, because they've been shooting over a long period of time trying to finish this film. But, it's a movie called Hunter that shot in Chicago, and it's a vampire film. And I got to play a sort of a middle manager vampire. And in their film, the vampire community is more or less run like organized crime. They're kind of more like the
like
mafia.
Like Chicago City Hall.
Yeah. I mean, and so it's like they have this little club of vampires, and then, you know, they're very selective about who they turn into a vampire rather than just slaughtering and draining, you know. And if you have a vampire who's kind of not producing or not pulling his weight, then you send in the guy who comes in and goes, look, you know, you are not doing what you are supposed to be doing. So,
oh, man.
I like the accent you use for that, too. That's good.
That's good.
Are you that guy, Nick? Are you that guy in the movie that could go talk to people?
Yeah, I patterned my accent in Hunter. It's kind of like, it's a lot like Michael Rapaport's accent in Justified last season. You know, I wanted it to be like an accent that was really kind of unidentifiable as being from any place on the planet Earth, so that I might actually be from outer space.
No, you you nailed it, because as great as Michael Rappaport was last year, and by the way, he's great. I mean, a revelation. He was amazing on the show.
Yeah.
I have no fucking clue what part of the country he's from.
Right. And, but, like, here's the thing, though. Whatever accent that is, he's really committing to it.
Oh,
he's
trying.
Committed. He's, like, good at that accent.
It is a character from somewhere.
From somewhere in the South.
You would have to get Rappaport really high. Yeah. To have him tell you where in the South it's from.
It doesn't take you out of the story, but it doesn't put you in it.
No, and what's great, too, and here's why Justified's so great. Here's why great TV is great.
Yeah.
You will notice things like Alicia Witt and Michael Rappaport don't sound like they come from the same place at all.
No.
And you don't even think about it twice. You're fine.
Yeah.
Like, it's so great that you don't care.
You just write that shit.
Right.
Now, if it was a bad show, one of the first things you'd think about is, and these people don't even sound like, Cheers is a great example. Name one person other than Cliff Clavin who has a Boston accent on Cheers.
Yeah, right.
Nobody.
Right.
Cliff sounds like Homer Simpson if he was talking really fast.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But nobody has a Boston accent on Cheers. You know why no one cares? Because Cheers is great. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Yeah. It's true.
So is there anything you could talk about Justified? Do you know anything that's going to happen coming up? I know that was a huge season finale. I haven't really gotten to talk to you about it. You live.
Yeah.
So that's good news. And the bad news is we're kind of left with a little bit of a cliffhanger here, and we don't know what's going to happen. So is there anything that you know of or no?
Well, I can't say anything specific, obviously, because I don't really know anything specific. They haven't started making it up yet, frankly.
Until
the summer. But I do know this, that sort of the, you know, next year is going to be the big wrap up. It's going to sort of it's the last season. So I think that probably we're going to kill everybody. Everybody in the show. But I do know that sort of the broad theme for next season is that every character is going to have one last thing that they have to do before they, before they blank, you know. So it's like the whole thing about me coming up on retirement, and the whole thing with Raylan, and Raylan going down to Florida to be with his baby, and all that stuff. It's like everybody's going to go, okay, none of this can happen until we do this one last thing. So that's kind of the theme here.
I mean, if it was a typical show, I'd be like, okay, well, they're setting it up to where, like, Nick's going to be passing the torch to Erica. But since it's not a typical show, every time I guess what's going to happen on Justified, it never happens.
Something else happens.
Except the season finale, I knew exactly what was going to happen. But it was done so well, it didn't matter. Like, it was done so well that I was happy. I thought that was the only way it could really go. Like, the way they set up with what happens with Ava at the end of the episode. Like, you could see it coming, but it's done so well that you're kind of pumped for it. Yeah.
Yeah, and thank God they got her out of prison. I mean,
yeah, right. I mean, the prison stuff was really good, but I don't know how you could continue with Oz with women in prison for another year. So
it's like, how many cat fights can you really sit through? I mean, really.
Yeah.
It's like, I could cat fight like anybody else, but come on.
No, I do think it did hit like a tipping point last year where it was like, okay, this prison thing probably can't go much further unless something really serious happens. Either she's going to die in prison or she's getting out, one of the two. So that was a pleasant surprise at the end. All the acting's just been so good on the show. Mary Steenburgen's coming back, which I'm pumped about, because they really do set up her character for next year really well.
Right.
Yeah,
next year's fun. It really is. It's going to be a lot of fun. I have mixed feelings about it being the last year. I think it's always a luxury when you actually get to finish something, you know, when you actually get to finish a series instead of having it just sort of, okay, get your stuff, get out of here, they're canceled us, you know.
Yeah, we have that feeling of completeness.
Yeah, right.
But on the other hand, I mean, I'm going to miss it. I mean, it's been great. I've loved doing it. I've loved working with with Tim and Erica and Jacob and all those people, Graham Yost. I mean, I'm going to miss it on that level for sure.
Yeah, I could see where that's the case. I mean, I'm going to miss the show a whole ton, and I never worked on it. So I can imagine you guys would miss it quite a bit as well. But it gives you an opportunity, like I was talking to Kim Coates, because Sons of Anarchy wraps next year. My two favorite FX shows, they both wrap next year. And Sons of Anarchy wraps, but it gives Coates a chance, like a guy like Kim Coates, to go out and maybe do some more comedy and stuff now. He did drama for 7 years, and now he can go mix it up a bit. Are you looking to do some comedy, too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm always looking to do that. I mean, I've sort of been blessed over the years to be able to go back and forth, and I definitely told my agents, I said, you know, if there's any way we can go out of this one and go into a nice old-fashioned studio sitcom, that I would love it. You know, I haven't done one since Rodney, and that was a terrific amount of fun. So, yeah, I'd love to go back and do some comedy for sure.
That's great. I'm really happy you joined us, Nick, and hopefully we'll have you on right before the start of the new season of Justified.
Absolutely, Matthew, and I'll try to call in when Victoria and DDP are there with you. That'd be
fun. It's going to be a blast. Well, that'd trying to do this once a month. I'm trying to get a big wrestling name on once a month and get the Circe in on it because I'll tell you what, our ratings are good. They go through the roof when I have wrestlers on. Jim Ross last week was one of our highest rated shows.
Yeah.
I'll bet. You know who came on the show this year who was a huge wrestling fan is Will Sasso.
Yes, Will Sasso,
right.
Who does impressions of like Stone Cold and Hulk Hogan and stuff on Mad TV.
He was the greatest. And I actually had a scene with Will, and we were talking wrestling because he was – when they did the Three Stooges movie came out, they brought the Three Stooges on to the Monday Night Raw, you know, for like a promo thing. And then he got to go on the show and like fool around with the wrestlers and stuff. And he did some skits.
He had a match in WCW, Nick. He faced like Bret Hart or something.
Wow.
He went up against
Bret
Hart?
When they were struggling for ratings, Will Sasso did a whole angle in WCW for like a month, and he ended up wrestling, I think, Bret Hart.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got to get on my WWE Network subscription and look that one up.
That's right. Do you have the network yet? I know we were talking, and you said you were going to get it when you could figure out how to hook it up.
I'm telling you, it's like it keeps me awake at night.
It's
I'll be
great.
Laying there and going, I've got to go to sleep, but I've got to see this Dusty Rhodes match from 1983. You know?
Have you seen they uploaded all the Clash of the Champions?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been flipping through those, too. Yeah, absolutely.
That's what I've been going through, too. There's some really bad ones in, like, the middle where I'm like, oh, my God, this is terrible. But there is some really good stuff.
Yeah. Well, the Ultimate Warrior stuff that they've got on there is really great. I mean,
how great
gone
was
through that
documentary, Nick? How great was the documentary after he died?
That was so moving. It was really well done.
It was
and powerful. I was shocked.
Can you believe they put that documentary together like 4 days after he died? I mean, that is literally, this is not hyperbole. It is such a good documentary. It blows my mind that they did that in 4 days. Blows my mind.
I know. I don't know who they've got making that stuff, but they're geniuses, whoever they are.
They're underpaid, I'll tell you that. I know that. Because that Ultimate Warrior documentary, I've been telling people that aren't even wrestling fans, I'm like, you got to see this thing. It's that good.
Yeah.
It tells, like, such a great story, and you really invest in these characters that are in this documentary. It's just killer. I'm glad you checked that out. I meant to ask you about that, yeah.
Well, it's also the whole thing. You know, I never knew I don't think anybody did, the whole backstory between the Ultimate Warrior and Vince McMahon and why he left and exactly what happened. I mean, it tells that whole story in such a brilliant way.
Well, between
had part of this documentary done, and then they added the stuff at the end when he passed away.
But some of the documentary, I mean, that was all the week before he died. I mean, the whole documentary is like pretty much the week before he died, except the first 10 minutes. And it's like Warrior showing up at the headquarters and working out his deal. It's Warrior at the Hall of Fame. It's Warrior and Hogan. The two moments in that documentary that are just killer is the Warrior and Hogan reunion at the end.
Yeah.
And what Warrior gives McMahon the little engine that could.
Yeah. Right.
Those were the two killer things in that. Like it's emotional.
Yeah, it's great. And the Hogan Warrior meeting was just so awkward and just so careful and just like, you know, I kind of forgive you but not really, and I understand and thanks for saying that, but you know, it was just so kind of like not like a heartfelt big like hug, you know. It was just it was really,
because
you know,
Hulk's kind of an asshole. speaking of wrestling, I'm going to hit the gym. Nick, thank you so much for being on. We'll talk soon. Hopefully, when I'm out in L.A. working on this show, we can do some links, hit some golf.
That'd be great.
Yeah, I want to go golfing. Good talking to you, pal.
Good talking to you. If you didn't like this interview, you're probably fat.
That's right. Don't let those fat people get away with anything out there. Let's go.
Mikey, say goodbye, Nick.
Yeah, Nick, I will talk to you soon, brother.
All right, and next week we will be back with Diggy and David Krumholtz.
There we go.
There's a combo. That's a combo right there. Diggy, David Krumholtz.
David and Diggy.
Yep. All right, and we'll see you guys next week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.